journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second. Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, September 29th, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
Why is the FBI raiding homes of activists? The U.S. Census reveals widespread poverty, and a look at Propositions 21, 24, and 26. Plus, Detained in the Desert, a new play by Josefina Lopez, and this week's edition of The Right Hook.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The homes of several peace and justice activists in Midwestern cities were searched by the FBI last Friday, prompting accusations against the federal agency of muzzling dissent. Two homes in Chicago and six in Minneapolis were searched. Some activists from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, reported receiving phone calls from FBI agents, but were not searched. The search warrants used by the federal agents cite laws that prohibit Americans from providing material aid to terrorist groups. The agents sought evidence connected to the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Lebanese military group Hezbollah. All three foreign groups are classified as terrorist organizations by the State Department. Some of the activists whose residences were targeted are affiliated with the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. The Milwaukee residents who received phone calls are members of Students for a Democratic Society. Many of the activists, including those named in the warrant, identify as anti-war and social justice activists and were present in Minneapolis in November 2008, organizing against the Republican National Convention at the time. Additionally, some anti-war and labor activists have been subpoenaed to appear at a grand jury hearing in Chicago this October. As we covered on Uprising last week, the U.S. Attorney General released a report last week on Bush-era FBI surveillance and intimidation of activists that essentially amounted to a whitewash. Many suspected the report set the stage for continued questionable activity under Obama by a federal agency with a sordid past. My guest is Carlos Montes. He's a community organizer with a community service organization in East L.A. and a writer and activist with Fight Back News. Welcome to Uprising, Carlos.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Sonali.
Good morning. Now, I understand there was a demonstration yesterday in downtown Los Angeles against these FBI raids. What has the response been among activists to these raids?
The response has been overwhelmingly condemning the FBI raids and also extending the hand of solidarity and coming out to support everyone involved in this thing. I think that everyone is coming out to support, they're uniting. We're all uniting behind this because this is an attack on one. An injury to one is an injury to all. I think people realize that they can come after us today and next week it can be you.
And what about your own case? You are here in Los Angeles, but I understand you were named in the warrant?
I was named in the search warrant executed at the Twin Cities Anti-War Committee in Minnesota. And my name's on the list. I have not been visited yet.
And you haven't been subpoenaed either?
I haven't been subpoenaed, right. And other people who were on the list have been called or visited by the FBI. I was involved in the demonstration at 2008 against the RNC and have supported the Anti-War Committee in the past in their activities.
Do you think that these raids surveillance is specified at people involved in the 2008 RNC organizing?
That's part of it. Yes, it is, because we had 30,000 people marching on the first day, stopped the RNC. You know, we protested strongly against the warmongers. We totally condemned the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. And many of the organizations that we support and work with, like the Palestine Solidarity Group, the Columbia Action Network, and Students for Democratic Society, and Freedom Road Socialist Organizations, were there marching together against the warmongers of the RNC. And these are organizations that are anti-war activists. We are
There's even one SEIU labor activist in Chicago whose house was searched.
I know Joe. I know Joe and Stephanie. I've stayed at their homes when we go to labor meetings. I, in the past, was an activist with SEIU. That's how I got to meet Joe. And I found him and Stephanie to be strong fighters for labor rights and peace activists. Stephanie, his wife, years ago worked in the Puerto Rican community, organizing the community to defend themselves against police brutality and police frame-ups. All these folks, including myself, we're all activists for peace. We fight for the rights of oppressed people here in the United States. And we travel to Colombia. We've gone to the Palestine. I've gone to Colombia several times. And we meet with labor activists, human rights activists, indigenous communities.
What about the accusation of supplying material aid to terrorist groups like FARC, which is based in Colombia?
No, that's totally false. It's a lie. We've done nothing illegal. We've gone to Colombia, and we meet with the organizations that are involved in fighting for justice and human rights.
Have you met with FARC leaders or FARC members?
Years ago that we did, not we, but we had Jess did an interview for Fight Back. She was able to travel, this was almost like 7-8 years ago, traveled to the mountains of Colombia and met with Reyes and the FARC.
So as a journalist, basically.
As a journalist, right. You know, we go to Colombia, we go to Palestine. We've gone to Palestine to visit the Palestinian prisoners in the jails there, the PFLP, to interview them and get their story. We interview anyone who's willing to talk to us. If you look at the newspaper, Fight Back News, it's what binds us together. It's a network of activists, anti-war activists, labor activists, gay rights.
It also seems bizarre that the FBI would use this law prohibiting Americans from providing material aid to terrorist groups. As most anti-war activists know, we're struggling with financial issues ourselves here in the United States to make ends meet. Most anti-war activists are far from wealthy. And in terms of providing any kind of serious material support to any group, it sounds a little far-fetched.
It's far-fetched, but that's also, it's an attack. I think they're trying to demonize us. When they use the word terrorist, you know, people go, whoa, what did you do? What's going on? In the past, when I would organize in East LA, they would call me an outside agitator, a troublemaker, even though I grew up here in the community. And then in the past, they used the Red Scare. Now they're using the terrorist label.
Carlos, at this point, what are people, you think, going to do? I mean, there's people who've been activists who've been subpoenaed to appear at a grand jury hearing in Chicago. Are there any plans to organize both nationally and locally? And if so, how can people find out about it?
Yes, we have a website, stopfbi.net, stopfbi.net. We also have a lot of articles and solidarity statements and actions in fightbacknews.org. But there's been over 20 demonstrations nationwide. We're going to also call for demonstrations on October the 5th when the activists have been ordered to appear at the grand jury in Chicago. We're going to condemn this. We're going to fight this. We're not going to cooperate with this. This has been an attack on us and an attack on the progressive movement in the United States. And we're saying no to the FBI harassment. As I said, we've done nothing illegal. All we've done is exercise our freedom of speech.
Well, Carlos Montes, I want to wish you the best of luck, and thanks so much for joining us today and updating us on what's been happening.
Thank you very much.
Carlos Montes is an organizer with Community Service Organization in East LA, a writer and activist with Fight Back News, and he recommends stopfbi.net and fightbacknews.org as websites where you can get more information about the recent raids that took place off activist homes by the FBI last Friday. Several people have also received intimidating phone calls from the FBI, and folks like Carlos Montes, my guest, have been named in the search warrants. We turn now to the U.S. Census Bureau, which released its 2009 American Community Survey yesterday, revealing that the Great Recession hurt many aspects of American life, from employment and family incomes to marriage rates, health insurance, and home ownership. Household income fell in 34 out of 50 states, and more than half of all Americans were affected, with the income gap between the wealthiest and poorest Americans widening dramatically. Most impacted, however, were young people, people of color, and those with a high school diploma or less. Here in Los Angeles County, the poverty rate jumped to 16.1% in 2009. That's up from 15.2% in 2008. Broken down by racial groups, the poverty rate for Latinos is the highest at 21.9%, followed by 19.7% for African Americans. Asians suffer from a 10.5% poverty rate, with whites having the lowest rate at 9.3%. Additionally, 29% of LA County's full-time workers earned less than $25,000 in 2009. The U.S. Census also revealed that 22.6% of Angelenos, that's 2.2 million people, lacked health insurance in 2009. That's almost a percentage point more than the year before. Well, joining me in studio this morning is Jesslyn Coley. She is a researcher for the 2009 Lane Analysis of the U.S. Census Bureau's American Community Survey. Welcome to Uprising, Jesslyn.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So let's talk about what poverty means, because I think that's an important measure of how to look at these statistics. The poverty line, the federal poverty line, according to that, there's 16.1% poverty in Los Angeles. First of all, just by that measure, is it staggering?
No, that's definitely staggering. That's up from 15.2% in 2008. And this is also the first data that's showing the impact of the Great Recession. So this is the first time we've been able to really analyze its impact on the local level. But as you said, Sonali, that's really only half of the story. That the vast consensus is that the federal poverty line is just out of date and it's a flawed measure. It doesn't take into account regional differences, and it doesn't take into account any changes since the 1960s, such as the vastly and quickly rising health insurance costs, rising housing costs, or any of the other costs associated with modern living. So a lot of people don't realize that if you're a single person making more than $12,000 a year in Los Angeles County, the government doesn't consider you poor, which is completely unrealistic.
$12,000 a year is supposed to cover rent, food, and everything.
Yes.
For anybody living in LA, that's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah. So we think that poverty is far worse than what the numbers suggest. And the standard that we use is 200% of the federal poverty line. So we think of the federal poverty line as a measure of extreme poverty, of extreme need. And 200% of the poverty line is a much better indicator of whether or not a family is able to meet their basic needs. Of course, this is not a standard to ensure that a family is thriving, but that a family has enough to meet basic needs and not have to rely on governmental assistance.
So at this more realistic standard of measuring poverty, how many Los Angelenos would classify as poor then?
Actually, and that's a really staggering number. That's 38% of the population in LA County.
Wow.
would then be classified as living in economic hardship in 2009. So that's nearly 3.7 million people in LA County.
So what about this other statistic that people who are working full time, 29% of people working full time, that's more than a quarter of all Los Angelenos who are working full time, earned less than $25,000 a year. So that's just about twice the federal poverty limit. So no matter, you know, we're not talking about unemployed folks here or part time workers, you're people who have full time jobs.
Exactly. Exactly, Sonali. That a lot of our conversations around the recession has focused on unemployment, but we also need to focus on the jobs that are actually existing right now and the ones that are being created, because we've had this issue of working poverty. It's not a new issue. It's symptomatic of systemic, persistent structural issues in LA County, because even when we look at a time when unemployment was at its lowest, in 2006, we had record unemployment at about 5%. But even then, about one in four workers was living under the poverty. It was living in economic hardship. So even then, we had working poverty. So
what you're saying is that even before this Great Recession and these new census results, you saw poverty rates pretty high in Los Angeles, and you know, they've worsened according to these latest census, but they were pretty bad before.
Yeah, yes, Sonali. And I mean, we've had a trend of having more and more jobs that are either low wage, low skill jobs, or either jobs in high wage, high skill areas. But what we've lost are middle wage, middle skill jobs. So we've really lost those in the economy. But what we've noticed is that with the recession, the recession has quantitatively, but not qualitatively, changed this trend.
What do you mean by that, quantitatively but not qualitatively?
What I mean is that this has been a trend that has been in place since about the 80s. Since the 80s, we've noticed that there have been more and more low-wage jobs and more high-wage jobs, but there have been less and less
middle income. So the quality of work has really, and the quality of employment has dropped.
Yeah. So, but the quantity of middle-wage jobs has been severely impacted by the recession. So, and where we've seen that jobs have been growing is that the vast number of jobs that have been growing have been in the low-wage sector.
What about children in Los Angeles? How are children faring?
And that's definitely, those numbers are pretty disheartening, that 22% of children in L.A. County live below the federal poverty line. So,
And that's
extreme poverty, exactly. So, and when we've looked at some other cities, we've looked at Long Beach. And in Long Beach, the rate is about 27-28%.
Wow.
So that's nearly a third of children growing up in extreme poverty.
My guest is Jocelyn Coley. She researched the U.S. Census Bureau's American Community Survey in 2009 for LANE, which is a local organization, an advocacy organization here in Los Angeles that's authored a number of studies on poverty, wages, and economic development. They also have a new Poverty Resource Center that features analysis of the data on their website at lane.org/poverty, and LANE spelled with two A's, LAANE.org/poverty. I mentioned the racial breakdown when I was introducing you, how Latinos are faring worst of all in terms of poverty rates, with African Americans a very close second. Does this kind of racial breakdown appear worse now than before the recession hit?
Unfortunately, Sonali, we've seen this in our reports that we've done even before the recession, that there definitely has been disparities in income amongst people of color and their white counterparts. And right now, people of color are twice as likely to live in extreme poverty than their white counterparts.
So if they were, if people of color were bad off before the recession, how much worse off are they now? Have the rates at which they're entering poverty levels increasing? Are they disproportionately hit, by the recession than their white counterparts?
I mean, as we all know, unfortunately, that race and socioeconomic status are, are often linked. So we've seen low-wage communities being hit the hardest. So we've definitely seen that segment of the population being hit, and in that way that we have seen that people of color communities have also been hit harder.
So let's talk about what are some ways in which people are able to deal with these statistics, and what LANE is going to do knowing all of this bad news, because it's, as you've alluded, not really a surprise.
Yes, Sonali. So some of the things that LANE has been really advocating for some time now is both for public investment in the economy. One example that we have is that recently stimulus dollars have combined with local money and have helped fund construction on a new metro line, the exposition line. And there's a program that we have in place that ensures that those jobs that are being created are good jobs that offer affordable family health care and are prioritizing people in areas with the highest unemployment rates that they actually get those jobs.
So are these sorts of statistics in the end, you think, going to be useful in educating policymakers about what to do about the Great Recession? Because we, as you've said, we've heard these statistics before. The census reveals in great clarity how bad things are with the Great Recession. Do they get taken seriously in spite of all of the sort of crazy right-wing attacks we hear against the Census Bureau itself?
Well, I really hope so. And I think that policymakers are listening, that they are realizing that the impacts of this recession are going to last for a long time. And as we know that we're supposedly in a recovery right now, but it's been a jobless recovery. And the jobs that have been are being created, Job growth is disproportionately driven by industries with median wages below $15 an hour.
So they're creating really bad jobs, if they're even creating jobs at all.
Exactly. So we saw that of the net job losses during 2008 to 2009, about 35% occurred in industries paying below $15 an hour. But in 2010, those industries are now accounting for 76% of job growth. So it's a really disproportionate number of jobs being created in low-wage sectors of our economy. But another area that Lane advocates good policies in is also by advocating for the public sector to set standards on private industry. And a recent policy we passed is in the Century Boulevard area near LAX, where we pass a living wage ordinance that affects hotel workers in that area.
So basically, any company, any hotel in that area would have to pay their workers what
a living wage. Exactly. And what we found is that through just this one policy will bring in at least $24 million over 4 years. And that's a very conservative estimate. And that includes both wages and benefits that are given directly to the workers, but also includes a multiplier effect. When workers' wages are increased, they are spending it back in the local economy. So that leads to additional revenue being created in this area. And as we know, that area is a low-income community. So this is a community that is now really getting an influx of money that is going to help them.
So that's a good example of the way in which people can hold the private sector accountable. Justine Coley, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and best of luck to you and Lane in your work.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
You can find out more about Lane's work on their website at lane.org. That's L-A-A-N-E.org. And their new Poverty Resource Center is online at lane.org/poverty. And we'll link to those from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. This is Uprising. Later in the hour, we will hear from Josefina Lopez. The acclaimed playwright joins us in studio to discuss her newest play called Detained in the Desert. And after this week's edition of The Right Hook, three propositions on this November's ballot that deal with taxes. Propositions 21, 24, and 26. Stay tuned.
Welcome to The Right Hook, a weekly segment which covers the machinations of the right wing, from the Republican Party to the Tea Party Patriots and beyond. I'm Chris Bennett. Tea Partiers and Republicans generally say they want the federal government so weak that they can drown it in a bathtub. For every rule, there's an exception. Utah's Tea Party Senate candidate, Mike Lee, demonstrates that American exceptionalism is alive and well. In 2007, Lee began his stint at international law firm Howry LLP and worked on behalf of Energy Solutions, a nuclear waste management company. Energy Solutions wanted to import 1,600 tons of Italian nuclear waste and dump it in Utah. When Utah officials and 76% of residents opposed the idea, Mike Lee and Energy Solutions sued. According to Lee, it was only the federal government which could decide whether nuclear material could be imported, not the Utah state government. When asked during a radio interview if his litigation forced Utah to accept the nuclear waste, Lee replied, quote, "Correct." Energy Solutions eventually lost the suit, but Mike Lee has tipped his hand to voters. When it's a case of getting caught between the principle of states' rights versus siding with the feds in order to make a quick buck, Tea Partiers clearly support a strong central government. New York gubernatorial candidate Carl Paladino looked ahead to his time in office this week and said, quote, "It's not going to be pretty. It's going to be very confrontational." The millionaire Buffalo developer, who gained notoriety by his authoring and forwarding racist emails, still has to beat Andrew Cuomo in the election. But Paladino gave a clue as to what his administration might look like. He favors cutting Medicaid in order to stem the flow of, quote, immigrants and other people who come to live in New York. Paladino claims the state's overly generous policies are, quote, inviting every Tom, Dick, and Harry poor and disenfranchised person to come to New York State. We don't want them. They're the responsibility of the federal government or the place they came from. Paladino also said that campaigning was the most disgusting thing he'd ever been involved with, but he's willing to put up with that in order to do the real job of being governor. Polls show Andrew Cuomo ahead of Paladino, but the margins vary wildly, from 6 points to 19 points to 33 points, according to the Quinnipiac University, Marist, or Siena polls. After the NAACP officially recognized the Tea Party as a racist organization, leaders of the right-wing AstroTurf group vowed to show the world that it was not so. Now a new tracking poll from the online right-wing Pajama TV shows that a third of African Americans strongly support the Tea Party. Author and political analyst Earl Ofari Hutchinson dismisses this poll as pure propaganda. There were only 543 likely voters who were African Americans, and PJTV has not disclosed its methodology or what questions the poll included. Of course, this has not stopped the conservative Fox Nation from posting the poll on its website. Last night was the first debate between Attorney General Jerry Brown and former eBay CEO Meg Whitman. The Christian Science Monitor boiled it down to whether political novice Whitman could do more than simply attack Jerry Brown, and if Brown could avoid losing his temper with Whitman. Both candidates went into the debate looking to avoid making viral YouTube-worthy gaffes. Democrat Barbara Boxer and Republican Carly Fiorina will face off this afternoon at 1 p.m. on NPR affiliate KPCC. For Uprising, I'm Chris Bennett, and this is The Right Hook, reality-based news and views.
Thanks, Chris. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Taxes are always a hot topic, spurring heated debates and even the upstart Tea Party. Three tax-related propositions will be on California's ballot in November, Propositions 21, 24, and 26. Prop 24, called the Tax Fairness Act, targets three recently enacted corporate tax loopholes. In 2008 and 2009, the California legislature approved $1.3 billion in tax cuts that benefit less than 2% of California's businesses. One tax cut gave businesses more flexibility in how they calculated their tax rate. Another allowed more opportunities to claim a tax refund from previous years based on the losses of the current year. And the third allowed different companies operating under the same management to share tax credits. Prop 24 supporters say that corporations that benefit from these tax cuts laid off 100,000 employees in 2009 while paying their CEOs a combined $8.5 billion. These same businesses have also spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to defeat Prop 24. The No on 26 campaign says that measure, dubbed Stop Hidden Taxes, is backed by the oil, alcohol, and tobacco industries. Prop 26 would change California's constitution, redefining regulatory fees like those imposed on major polluters as taxes. If 26 passes, a two-thirds vote of the legislature is required to approve any new taxes that were once considered fees. The No on 26 campaign says approval by supermajority is nearly impossible to achieve, and these fees are currently used to fund environmental cleanup efforts and programs that address the negative effects of tobacco and alcohol use, among other things. Finally, Prop 21, the third initiative on taxes, would increase vehicle licensing fees by $18 to fund state parks. My guest is Lenny Goldberg, the executive director of the California Tax Reform Association. Welcome to Uprising, Lenny.
Oh, thank you for having me, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Let's go through these one by one. Let's go back to Prop 24, which, as I mentioned, would close three corporate tax loopholes. What's the position that you take on Prop 24?
Well, we're very supportive of that. And, you know, I wish the media generally described these measures as clearly and as well as you just described them. I wish you were representative of the entire media in talking about these, because you nailed it very well. These loopholes, the only thing missing there is, though, is that the official estimate is about $1.3 billion, but we think this will save way closer to $2 billion, and those estimates were done a while ago. It looks like these loopholes will be more and more costly. But here, the Prop 24 repeals loopholes that were passed in secret. I work on tax policy in Sacramento, and we always have hearings on these issues. No hearings, no language, done as part of a middle-of-the-night budget deal where, in order to get some additional revenues on a temporary basis, suspending some of the current corporate loopholes, the corporate lobbyists and the Republicans push the Democrats to these long-term permanent loopholes. Now, one of them is an embarrassment to the state of California, and that is one that says you get to choose how much income you want to ascribe to California in any given year.
So if you make a lot of money, you say, I'm going to choose a formula that minimizes my tax. If you make some losses, you want to increase your losses because you can roll them forward or roll them back. And you'll say, oh, I'll choose a formula that increases my liability, in this case, increases my losses, and then we can run them against my profits in future years or past years.
So, now, wouldn't it be lovely if individuals could claim such taxes, right?
It would be great if we had those choices. And no, you know, people talk about, we're adopting formulas done by other states. No other states have it like this. This was an effort in the middle of the night, basically, to say, oh, well, we don't want to make out-of-state companies pay more. And it turns out, and that's why I say the numbers are short, are too low. It turns out that just that ability to choose and switch back and forth costs $850 million to $1 billion a year. And it was estimated as, oh, well, it doesn't matter that much if we're giving these companies a choice. Now, interestingly, these companies are only large multi-state multinational. Small businesses do not have multi-state and multinational ability to shift income around and to allocate income to California.
All so these tax loopholes disproportionately are in favor of the biggest corporations.
No, not quite. They are only in favor of the biggest corporations because, in fact, if you're a small business and you want to play the games that the big corporations get, you should invest out of state and then be able to move your income around. It's that bad. So it only affects multi-state, multinational, largest corporations. They all get a choice. Now, one of the things interesting is that among the biggest contributors to the no on 24 have been media companies. Disney, NBC, Universal, actually General Electric owning them, big media companies, Time Warner, who are basically able to lower their tax bill without creating a single new job. And that's because they sell all over the world. They have a lot of employees and property in California, mostly in Southern California, and they get to change the formula. So they base their income at the income on sales and not the investment they have in California.
And, of course, these are the major media companies that are supposed to be reporting on things like Prop 24 in an unbiased way.
There is that, too. Thank you for that. That's an addition. But mostly they're companies that are going to do what they're going to do. They're not going to create a single new job. They don't have to create a single new job. And they get a huge tax cut. And that's what the legislature did. So now they're all running around saying, oh, you know, this is bad for business in California. Well, one thing that people need to understand is that this has not even taken effect yet. So they haven't. Fortunately, if we repeal it now, they can start all over again. If there are elements of this package that make sense, then the legislature can reenact them. This is a very unique initiative. It just repeals the bad stuff that they did. Let me give you one more issue here, because you mentioned it too. On the ability to carry back losses, if this had been in place a few years ago, Countrywide, who made all this money in subprime and helped part of bringing us belly up, would have paid a lot of taxes in 2006. And when they went belly up in 2008 and the state and everybody else were struggling, we would have had to write refund checks for the taxes they had previously paid. This is bad budgeting and terrible tax policy.
Very briefly, who has put Proposition 24 on the ballot?
Well, the California Teachers Association put Proposition 24 on the ballot, and they have some support of other public employee groups because basically it's a budget issue. It's an education issue.
Right.
And, you know, and we've been we will make continual cuts in education unless we can repeal these new tax loopholes.
And so you have, you're advocating a yes on Prop 24.
Oh,
let's go to Prop 26. I'm guessing you don't like this proposition.
Well, I'm working very heavily on the no side. I've been part of running the campaign, as well as with the California Tax Reform Association. And you described it well, except that it's worse than it even seems in your description, which is that it effectively says that anything to protect public benefit or public interest other than just a licensing or occupying a space is a tax, not a fee. And by making it a tax, not a fee, not only is it two-thirds of the legislature, and this is where it really gets bad, is that local fees that are done all the time on businesses that dig up the streets, that need more police or traffic control for a large event, for pipeline safety is one of the issues that they mention.
In context of the San Bruno disaster. But,
that's exactly right. Many of the normal regulatory fees that cities or counties put on businesses to pay for mitigation costs, to pay for cleanup costs, for hazardous waste.
So they want those to be used as taxes instead of fees.
Those would become taxes. And what does it mean as a tax? It means that it has a two-thirds vote of the voters are required. The way we've tied things up already is that for a local tax that's dedicated to a specific purpose, like cleaning up hazardous waste, that would have to be a two-thirds vote of the voters. So I was in a meeting presenting to county supervisors who couldn't agree on anything else, who were many of them very conservative, many, you know, others liberal. They argued about all the other initiatives on the ballot, and when we got to 26, they overwhelmingly opposed it. Even the LA Daily News is against it for reasons that are exactly what I just said, that even at the local level, you cannot provide for a fee on a cable company for digging up the street. You can't provide a fee on a rock concert for the extra police and traffic control that it would require. And it's not me that's saying it. The good news in this campaign is that proponents put out a list of fees like pipeline safety and traffic control at events that said these would be affected. They'd all become taxes, requiring two-thirds vote of the people. It actually so handcuffs and locks down state and local government. It is polluter protection. It is put on by oil, tobacco, and alcohol. But it is so severely flawed. Actually, let me raise one other flaw, which is really helping us in this campaign to defeat it. It has a provision that would eliminate a $1 billion deal as part of the budget last February. It goes retroactive. And it also says that if any single taxpayer is paying more, it doesn't matter if the proposal loses money for the state or is neutral to the state, but if you switch around taxes and somebody has to pay a little bit more, any one person has to pay more, it would become a tax, requires a two-thirds vote. There was a gas tax swap that everyone supported, but it didn't get a two-thirds. The Republicans didn't support it in February. This would overturn that and cost the state $1 billion immediately.
And
an immediate hit on the budget.
The companies that are supporting Prop 26 include ExxonMobil, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Philip Morris, Anheuser-Busch, etc., and they're calling it a stop hidden taxes proposition. So you're saying no on Prop 26.
On Prop 26, these companies just don't want to pay for the cost of the damage they do. If people can remember nothing else, it's oil, tobacco, and alcohol, polluter protection. They don't want to pay for the damage they do. It's a really insidious measure.
Very briefly, we just have a few minutes left. Let's talk about Prop 21, which is a third initiative on taxes that would increase vehicle licensing fees to fund state parks. Most Californians like their state parks. What do you say, a yes or no to Prop 21?
Well, I would say yes. Yes, but, you know, I think that it's the thing about this, it's very straightforward. People can decide. It does have a benefit. $18 on your vehicle will pay
per
for
year.
State park per year, will pay for state parks, and will give that vehicle, any California license plate, free admission to the state park so you don't have to pay a fee. So if you go three times or three or four times to a state park or spend a couple days there, it'll save you the money.
That sounds good to me.
That sounds pretty good, but, you know, other people argue that there are a lot of people with low-value cars who are still going to pay the $18 and never get to
a state park. It can be a regressive tax since it's a flat tax.
It is a flat tax. Right. That's correct. And so, I think the supporters believe that it will pass because it's not just that you're paying to keep the state parks alive and supported, but also that you are getting something for your money. You're getting free admission to the state park.
Well, I want to thank you, Lenny Goldberg, very much for joining us today. Throw out a website for your organization.
Well, it's www.caltaxreform.org, and you can also look at knowonproposition26.com. I'm not sure what the Prop 24 website
is.
We'll
link to all of the websites for the campaigns, yes, for the propositions on our website later today,
good,
as well as your site, caltaxreform.org. Lenny Goldberg, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Sonali. I really appreciate it.
Lenny Goldberg is the executive director of the California Tax Reform Association. Again, you can check out their website at caltaxreform.org. He recommends a yes on Prop 24, a no on Prop 26. And on Prop 21, well, you can decide. It's a pretty straightforward proposition that would increase your vehicle licensing fees by $18 per year. That would go towards supporting state parks, funding state parks in California, and give you free admission to any state park here in the state. We will be continuing our coverage of propositions between now and the end of the week. And so do listen to Uprising. You can also check out our website at uprisingradio.org for the ones that we've already covered. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, acclaimed playwright Josefina Lopez joins us in studio to talk about her latest play, Detained in the Desert. Stay tuned.
We have our fall fun drive. It's right around the corner. It's coming up, and then we kick off next Tuesday, October the 5th. You can call 818-985-2711, extension 513, to set up a shift to volunteer. Or you can log on kpfk.org and click on volunteer for details. Remember, this is your radio station. Come along and be a part of it.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. In the new play, Detained in the Desert, a young Latina woman and an anti-immigrant radio host in Arizona each become entangled by the consequences of harsh immigration legislation. Detained in the Desert was written by Josefina Lopez, who co-wrote the screenplay for the hit film Real Women Have Curves. Lopez emigrated to the United States from Mexico at the age of 5 and spent years living in fear of being deported. In 1987, she was a beneficiary of the Simpson-Rodino Amnesty Bill, which legalized thousands of undocumented immigrants. Her new play is a satirical drama inspired by Arizona's controversial immigration policy, SB 1070. Detained in the Desert opens this Friday, October 1st, and runs for 12 performances at Casa 0101 in Boyle Heights. It's directed by Hector Rodriguez, a regular collaborator with Lopez and the resident director at Casa 0101. Josefina Lopez joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you so much. Thank
I should
you.
Say welcome back.
It's yes, always, I love coming back to your show. And
it's always great to have you here. And this time, as you have done in the past, it is personal. You tend to write about things that reflect your own life. First, before we get into this play itself, tell us a little bit more about what I mentioned, your own past as an immigrant living in fear of being deported.
Yes, you know, my parents brought me here when I was 5 years old, and I didn't know I was undocumented until a little bit later when my parents would tell me not to tell anyone I didn't have papers, and I was like, toilet paper? What does that mean? I didn't know, you know.
Yeah.
And sure enough, you know, when I wanted to go to college, that's when I really knew that I didn't have papers because, I couldn't go to college. But yeah, 13 years I was undocumented.
And it's amazing when you talk about going to college, because it sort of brings up all of these issues that we've discussed so much on this show recently about the DREAM Act.
That's
and
right.
Today's young undocumented students don't have that opportunity. You were able to get amnesty.
Yes, it was
of the
like
bill.
Deus ex machina, because I graduated from high school and then this law came in. And I consider myself very lucky, but I feel so sad. I cried when I found out the DREAM Act, the bill was, but they wouldn't even hear it.
And there are so many potential Josefina Lopez
there
among
are.
These
there
young
are so many people
students.
That want to contribute to this country. Mm. And it's like, why not give them the opportunity?
Mm. So this law that was passed in Arizona in 1070, it just happened a few months ago.
In April, yes.
So you must have written this play pretty fast.
I was so angry and so inspired. But I actually had a lot of material from other things, because last year, if you remember, Lou Dobbs was kicked off.
Hosted?
CNN. Yes, thank you.
Disappeared?
Yes. And I had heard about how there was a rise in hate talk, or there was the whole immigration, you know, debate. You know, it just all of a sudden like became the big thing because that's what Republicans are using to get reelected. And so there was a rise in hate talk, and that increased in a rise in hate crimes. And I was reading about the hate crimes in Shenandoah, in Long Island, and other events. And there was I think there were these three hate killings. There were a group of white teenagers who were, you know, took bats and killed these men. And they were basically yelling and saying epitaphs and the kinds of things that Lou Dobbs and Bill O'Reilly and all these, you know, people use. And so it was like, wow, like you really see the power of words. Like you can take words to create possibility, or you can take words and, you know, someone can go take a bat and use those words in your name. And so it was really infuriating to discover this. And I said, God, I have to do something, especially with Shenandoah, the fact that there was police cover up and that there was a whole town that conspired to cover this up. And so I was thinking about a lot of things. And then last February, I went on a Marcha Migrante. That's a migrant march. That's it's sponsored by Border Angels. And they're a group that, you know, puts water out in the desert. So I actually joined Enrique Morones and a group of people who were interested. And we went out to a lot of the points in the desert where a lot of migrants stop. And the marcha ended at the Holtville Cemetery in Arizona, where there's over 700 people that are unidentified, who have unmarked graves. And so we went there to pray for them, to let them know that they are not forgotten. And there's been over 10,000 people that they have found in the desert that have died. And so there was a lot of things. And so this law was really it was like that's it, the last straw. I have to write something. So, yes, I did write this very quickly. It almost was like inspired. I just felt like it was given to me because I had to say something.
Mm. And Lou Becker is the name of the hate talk radio host. tell us about the character, the Latina Sandy Sanchez, who is one of the two main characters alongside Lou Becker in your play. Who is she? How much of yourself figures in her, or people that you...
Well, you know, actually, I grew up as a little girl. I was born with blonde hair. And I was born, everybody thought I was white, you know, like, and so I had the opposite effect where people always thought I was white and I was called a gringa, you know. But Sandy has the other side where she was born in this country, but she's sort of like third generation, but she's dark. Mm-hmm. And so she just gets fed up with constantly having to prove that she's an American. And I think there's an incident, and I don't want to give away mm-hmm. too much of the
sure.
plot. But where you see racial profiling, but at the extreme, but it's kind of the ridiculousness of racial profiling that it just triggers her to go, oh, this isn't going to go down like this again. I'm tired of this. And I guess there's a lot of me in that. I've just had it, you know, with like constantly trying to prove that you're an American. You know, it's like I have a paper that says I'm a U.S. citizen, but you're always being questioned. Like you'll never be American because you're not white, you know.
It's interesting because there's a new campaign by Color Lines magazine to ban the I word, as they're calling it, the word illegal.
Oh, yes.
Stopping, especially the media, calling on the media to
exactly.
stop using the word illegal to describe people. And it really reminds us that of the ludicrousness of having a piece of documentation essentially identify who you are and encompass who you are rather than your personality or your culture or your background.
That's right. And also the word alien should be banned. You know, mm-hmm. I tell people when I was a little girl, I really believed I was an alien from another planet because you don't see any Latinos on, you know, growing up, I didn't see any Latinos on television. I didn't see anything except, you know, the few people in my neighborhood. And so I thought, well, maybe we really are from another planet. Maybe people don't know that we exist. And there was, I think I internalized the invisibility and I didn't realize how dehumanizing that was. Mm.
Even know? People who have papers, who are green card holders, are called resident aliens.
That's right. You know, we have antennas sticking out. You know,
like. So, Josefina, tell us a little bit about where and when the play is happening and who are some of the actors involved, how it was all put together.
Well, it came together very quickly because I finished the script June 1st. I was trying to meet a deadline for another playwriting contest, and then I said, you know what? I think this is ready to be produced because we got to say something now. And so my wonderful director, Hector, said, okay, let's do it. And so quickly we went into rehearsals. And, you know, we have a great cast because I was very concerned. I thought, okay, we're gonna need three white actors to come into Boyle Heights, a predominantly Latino immigrant neighborhood. And they're going to be saying a lot of racist things because they're basically just going to be saying what's already out there. And then Lou Becker, like something happens to him where he's probably going to be humiliated. He has some scenes where an actor really like has to expand themselves to be able to do these scenes. And I'm like, God, please, you know, send me some white actors who are cool, who get it, who like are not afraid of, you know. And you know, I have a great cast. I'm just so happy that there's been none of the racial tensions that I thought were going to be there because I was concerned. No, everybody's so cool. And Yvonne De La Rosa is playing Sandy. She's an amazing actress. And Carrie Fox is playing Lou Becker. And I really like, I salute him because I just think the kinds of things he's putting himself through are just amazing. And I just think he's such an amazing actor to be able to pull this off.
So Casa 0101.
Casa 0101. Like binary code. Yeah.
Okay,
Casa 0101 in Boyle Heights.
It is located 2009 East 1st Street in Boyle Heights.
That's right. And if you're scared to go to Boyle Heights, we're just like a block away from the police station. So don't be scared. We'll get mugged.
And it opens this Friday, October 1st. There are going to be 12 performances through Sunday, October 24th. It's showing Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Sundays at 5 p.m. You can certainly get tickets at casa0101.org. You can call 323-263-7684 for more information. 323-263-7684. And the name of the play is Detained in the Desert. And it's Josefina Lopez's latest play. You may know her from The Real Women Have Curves, the play and the film. Her last book, Hungry Woman in Paris, which we interviewed you about here on Uprising. So I want to bring up an issue that you just mentioned about how you thought of yourself as an alien as a child because you didn't see enough or hardly any Latinos on TV. And even today, despite the fact that the population has grown, poverty rates, we were just discussing earlier today, the census shows that Latinos are experiencing the worst poverty rates in all of Los Angeles County. Mm-hmm. Has the representation in the media of Latinos, even in popular media, for example, and in the arts, gotten better because of efforts of people like you?
Slightly better. It's really appalling to me that it's 2010 and we're still, you know, like I look at the Latinos that are on screen and there are some more positive portrayals. Obviously, you know, Jimmy Smith's playing, you know, a Supreme Court judge, you know, that's great. That's wonderful. But then we also, and I don't want to say names here, but we also look at like the Latina portrayals and we still have the hot señorita image. You know, that hot señorita image has been around since the beginning of cinema. They always need an ethnic female that's eroticized. So I'm really tired of that. I mean, I tell people when we see someone like Lupe Ontiveros, Lupe played the mother in Real Women Have Curves. Someone like her has so much talent,
she's
who's
amazing.
Been around. She started at the same time that Eddie almost started. Mm-hmm. And if you look at their careers as a Latina woman and a Latino man, like same talent, just the incredible disparity between, you know, the
so there's a
roles.
Gender disparity.
There's also
and
the gender disparity. And the racial. Yes. Mm-hmm. No, it is appalling. You know, I was very excited, you know, that there was a show called Outsourced, you know, and I was like, oh, that's interesting, you know, and I'm like, wow, you can get a show about people in India, but you can't get a show about Latinos when there's like 30% of the population. And I've been trying for 20 years to get Latinos on television. And I've written like at least over 8 TV pilots and I still can't. And part of it is that anytime you deal with immigration, for some reason, people want to stay away from that because it's too controversial. They don't want to deal with it. They want to say, no, no, we're all Americans. We're all equal. And it's like, you know what? No, maybe that's what you want to portray, but that's not the reality. And I don't want to lie about this. And I think that's probably why I can't get on get my shows on TV.
Well, if there are any Hollywood producers listening, please, please contact my guest, Josefina Lopez,
yes,
and ask for her TV pilots. We want to hear more of from you and see more of your work for sure. Josefina, back to your play, Detained in the Desert. What is following that? I mean, do you hope that the play has a longer run? Could it also develop into, like Real Women Have Curves
yes,
did, into
I think
a potential
it has
screenplay?
Legs to be a film because, I definitely think it has legs, you know. And it's funny, like, you know, there was a report written by, I think, Marsha Norman about how in theater, like, most of the plays that are presented are written by men, 80% of the plays,
wow.
20%. And then she wrote a play where they had a gun. And just because that play had a gun, all of a sudden, you know, she got all these awards. And it's funny because I usually don't write plays with guns in them, but this is my first play with a gun. So I'm thinking, I wonder.
Because it does involve Arizona and the desert.
The desert, yes.
There you go.
And you know, police profiling. So, and I'm like thinking, you know, this isn't quite like my work, but I wonder if this will get more attention just because there is a gun and there's more a little bit more violence, which I'm not necessarily promoting. But I do hope that more theater companies will present this play, or at least, if not my play, a play that speaks up to this.
Josefina Lopez, as always, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck to you, and thanks for coming in here. Detained in the Desert opens this Friday, October 1st, goes through Sunday, October 24th, Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m., Sundays at 5 p.m. You can get tickets through casa0101.org or by calling 323-263-7684. And also, stay tuned for our fund drive starting next week. We're going to have some chances for you to win free tickets to the play during our fund drive. Casa0101 is located at 2009 East 1st Street in Los Angeles in Boyle Heights. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I wanted to quote Gloria Anzaldúa, who once said, "Why am I compelled to write? Because the world I create in the writing compensates for what the real world does not give me. By writing, I put order in the world, give it a handle so I can grasp it." That's Gloria Anzaldúa. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our interim assistant producer. Kristen Culbert is our intern. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Our website is uprisingradio.org, where you can find local events and links and other information that we mention on the air. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.